Hello and welcome. You're listening to Herald Extra, the podcast that looks behind the scenes at some of the articles in each month's Presbyterian Herald. I'm Sarah Harding, the editor of the Herald, and today we'll be discussing the February 2020 edition. This is only the second time we've done a themed edition, certainly in my time as editor, but we felt that mental health is such an important topic, especially at the moment, and we really wanted to give it a lot of space and also tackle it from a number of different angles, so we decided to devote the whole magazine to it. Today I'm joined by Dr. Sharon Hastings, who herself has suffered from severe mental illness and recently written a book about her experiences, and also Jamie Meeklam, who is the founder of Made for More, a charity that helps young people with a number of different issues, including mental health. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Sharon, I'll come to you first because in many ways you are the reason why we have done a themed edition. I think it was back in 2015 that you first contacted me with the idea of writing an article about your struggles with mental health. And at the time, I was very keen to do that, but I really wanted to kind of link it into a number of different articles. So I kind of parked it to one side for a while. And as often happens in this job, suddenly we're 4 years on and nothing had happened. But thankfully, you reminded me, you got back in touch again. And in those intervening years, you then written a book about your experiences. So actually we both felt that really this was perhaps God's timing in the whole thing, and this was the time to do something big on mental health, and so it kind of sparked the idea that we could devote the whole magazine to that subject. So your article in the magazine doesn't delve too deeply into your story because obviously you cover a lot of that in your book, but I thought it would be helpful to let listeners know just a little bit about how your problem started and the sorts of things that you were experiencing.
Well, my problems really started while I was at medical school. In my fourth year, I started to go downhill and was missing class with back pain and different things. And I just didn't feel 100% well, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. And in the summer, before I started my final year, I went to stay with my aunt in California for a while. He's always been very supportive of me, and we're quite close, even though she was far away. And she noticed that I was not interested in doing any of the usual things people want to do in California, like go to the beach or anything. I was tending to get up, have breakfast with her and go back to bed. Mm-hmm. And one night we were sitting on the veranda outside and she just said, "Miss Sharon, something's really wrong with you and I don't know what you think about it." And then she sort of said, do you think it could be depression? And this word had been floating about in my head, but I'd been far too frightened to actually admit that maybe this was what was wrong with me, because I thought you can't be a medical student and come into your final year and graduate as a doctor and have this D word hanging over you. But anyway, I did go home with an appointment for my GP, which she had insisted upon. And when I talked to her, she asked me all those questions I had been told about in psychiatry, you know, how is your mood, are you losing your appetite, how's your sleep and all these things. And I realised I was textbook at that stage, depression. So I started having quite a lot of input from the mental health services throughout my final year, because basically the psychiatrist who saw me realised, you know, this girl's not going to get through without major help. But I really, really went very much downhill. I stopped eating. And I lost a lot of weight. And then in the January of my final year, I was detained in hospital. And at that stage, my diagnosis was major depressive disorder and a non-specific eating disorder. I got through my finals, which was a bit of a miracle. But as time went on, other symptoms started to creep in. And I experienced my first episodes of mania. But looking back, there had been sort of low-level mania episodes probably in my early years at medical school. But I became very, very high and spent money in not good ways, and got myself into a fair bit of trouble at times with the mania. And then that was treated. I was diagnosed then with bipolar as opposed to just the major depressive disorder. And then in time again, I started to have these psychotic episodes, psychosis being a loss of touch with reality, where I was having tormentors, as I called them, flapping around my head and mocking me and laughing at me. And I felt really, really, it was really traumatizing. But then I'd been in hospital again a few times, and the psychiatrist decided, no, your diagnosis is schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So that's what I've been treated for since 2011, and I've had more hospital admissions. And but good things have happened too, and I would like to think today that I'm managing it a wee bit better, even though it's considered a severe and enduring mental illness, which I will deal with for life, really.
Yeah. It's fair to say, you mentioned a wee bit there about the stigma. There is still a lot of stigma around mental health. For you in particular, though, there's probably things that made that worse, things like the fact that you were a doctor. Also, what you were experiencing, that schizoaffective disorder, people don't really understand too much about that, so there's probably a bit of fear and a misunderstanding. And also, being a person of faith, being a Christian, would you say that you really felt the pressure of any of all of those things or any of those things?
Yes, and I think it went through phases, because when I was first depressed, there were people who literally asked me that sort of cliche question, where's your joy? You know, where's your joy in the Lord? And haven't you prayed about this and things? And there were some people who were opposed to me taking medication for depression. And within the church I was at, I had some prayer ministry, and people began to get frustrated that I wasn't getting better, to the point where people were praying for the strongholds in my life. And I started to think, like, do these people think I'm demon possessed or something? It was really, really, I felt really stigmatized, and I moved away from that prayer ministry. Then later, when I started to tell people I was bipolar, that was coming out in conversation in other places at that time, and it felt easy enough to say that. But when the diagnosis got changed to schizoaffective disorder, that prefix, schizo, scares people. Because quite often where they hear about people with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, it's in the news where there's been a crime and somebody's been reported as having paranoid schizophrenia. And what people don't realise is that kind of illness actually makes you much more vulnerable to being a victim of crime rather than to perpetrating it. Mm-hmm. So even today, when I meet people newly in the church, I find it quite hard to say I have schizoaffective disorder. I do feel maybe some of it's self-stigma that I'm putting on myself, and maybe other people don't see it in the same way, but certainly I feel that. And that's been kind of my journey through that, you know.
Yeah, it's difficult to cope with then. And you did say there, and you mentioned in the article, that people with mental health difficulties are often unlikely to have their symptoms completely removed, and that's certainly the case for you. So how do you find it living with mental health issues? Do you find it gets more manageable?
To be honest, it is still very, very challenging, and I have had 6 relatively good months where I haven't had any hospital admissions, which is actually a record for me in the 5 years that I've been married. So I'm learning, when I have really difficult weeks, that these things do tend to pass, because I've been there before and I have come up again. But still, I do find it very difficult, and I'm trying to get ahead of things a little bit and not rely so much on other people to pick me up when I fall. Like, I used to go have a really bad day and things would just escalate, and I would become more and more anxious and more, like, paranoid. And my husband would have to say to me, Sharon, you need to take your as-needed medication. You know, you need to do this. So I've been trying, especially since I wrote the book and read for myself how God has worked in my life and how, you know, I feel like I need to live more intentionally as a Christian. Now I'm trying to think, like, this is going downhill. I need to take action here, and I'm trying to be a bit more proactive about managing my symptoms and getting in early. And I'm fortunate to have very good support around me. I have a community psychiatric nurse who I see nearly every week, and then there's quite a lot of input from the psychiatry team as well, because my illness has been so complex. And in 3 years there just passed, I had 15 hospital admissions. So yes, it's ongoing, it's difficult. My book is not about healing from schizoaffective disorder, it's about living with schizoaffective disorder, but with God behind me and enveloping me. And I kind of conclude in the book that I'm held, even though I'm struggling, even though I might be out of touch with reality, that God is still good and that he gives me strength to get through all of the difficult episodes. So,
well, your book is called Wrestling With My Thoughts. Was it difficult to sort of go back through everything, or did you find it quite cathartic to write?
A mixture of both. I mean, parts of it were cathartic, parts of it were very difficult. Even rereading it when I came to do the copy editing and the proofreading and things like that, I obviously had to read the book again very closely, and it made me very sad. I grieved for a lot of the things that I had lost, you know, like the possibility of practicing as a doctor once I graduated, and just for some of the really painful things that I went through. I just thought, you know, I don't even know how I survived that. But in another sense, it wasn't that difficult to do because the memories are so strong. But the book is still, I hope, infused with hope, especially as I draw conclusions at the end and look back and see that even in those times where I actually denied my faith and said, I actually came to a point of saying I hate God because he's let this happen to me and he's not looking after me. But looking back, I can see he was there all along. And whenever I turned to him, he came running towards me with his arms open.
Yeah. Jamie, I'll bring you in here. So Sharon has very bravely told her story and put herself out there in this book and hopefully will help lots of people by doing that. And in a different way, you were brave in your journey. You describe it in more detail in the article, but basically you were a teacher and you saw a desperate need to help young people in a number of different areas. And so you quit your job, you set up Made for More, and you're now going into schools and youth groups to do workshops and hopefully help young people. What sort of situations were you experiencing as a teacher? Give us an idea. Why did you feel that it was so bad, things with young people, that you had to make this big step of faith?
Yeah, so I'd been teaching, I think it was 8 years by this point, and I'd been in a couple of schools and done a few placements and things. I also did a lot of church work, volunteering in the church. So, you know, I was involved with young people a lot, coaching rugby and stuff as well. So you were just seeing kids from all different backgrounds, you know, all different ages. And it became very clear that all of them were struggling. A PE teacher is a unique role. You probably get to know the kids better than other teachers because you're on bus trips. You know, you're maybe sitting in the change rooms having a chat with them, you know, before you go out on the pitch. You're walking down the pitches with them, so you're having a wee one-on-one. And you really do just get a flavour of their lives. You know, they were from 13, 14, they're heavily drinking at the weekends. You know, more and more of them are involved in a drug culture, you know, starting with cannabis and sort of happily then experimenting with other types of drugs. You're chatting with some of the young girls in either in school situation or church situation, and you can see very clearly how vulnerable they are and desperate just even for love and affection because maybe their home's broken. And then, you know, just in the classroom, I also taught Learning for Life and Work, and we would do a lot on trying to talk about self-esteem and self-worth. And you would just have, like, 16-year-old boys, you would happily put their hand up and say, I have no self-worth. You know, I don't like myself. You know, you didn't even need to probe some of these kids. You know, you would ask them to write down what they're good at, what they're bad at, and they'll fill the bad column. And they'll leave the good column empty, and you have to force them to write into it. You know, a lot of them just have no value of who they are. They don't love themselves at all. And then that shows in the fact that they're happy to go out and get drunk. You know, they're happy to go out and take drugs. That they'll get into fights. You know, that they'll self-destruct when things don't go well in school, and they'll not do coursework. They'll not revise for exams because they give up.
Yeah.
You know, some of them give up by the age of 13 before they even start thinking about GCSEs. And then I got involved more in mentoring with a group of young boys and things in the school. So that kind of brought me more into the pastoral care conversation at times. And what you were discovering were just a lot of angry young boys. You know, it's hard as a teacher when you have 30 kids in a classroom and you've got a couple of boys just constantly causing issues and disrupting the class. And they're just sort of seen as a pain, as a nuisance. But whenever you actually then start chatting with them, you realise that they've low self-esteem, that their home life is awful, you know, that's why they play up, they crave attention, you know, and it just really broke my heart, all of these conversations.
Yeah.
In the school or in the church. And for me, it was a case of, well, what is actually educating our young people? You know, what is actually teaching them truth, that who they are matters, that their decisions have consequences. You know, that's a big thing because you don't see that on Netflix. You know, you don't see it on reality TV shows. There's consequences to your actions and there's consequences for other people. Like, for me, that's being missed a lot of the time in schools because there's so much pressure on teachers to get grades that they don't have time to sit and go through these other things. So for me then, Learning for Life and Work was the key subject where I thought, this is a subject which can really start to shape and mould our young people if taught correctly.
Yeah.
But schools are kind of ignoring it.
Yeah.
They're pushing it to the side. They're maybe sliding it sort of down the pecking order in the timetable to get more maths, more English, you know, and as a result, our young people are missing out. So So when Made for More kind of was born in my heart, it was going to be built on one word, and that was identity. You know, I really felt that young people don't know who they are. They don't know why they're here. They have no purpose. And as a result, they're making all these bad decisions, you know. So for me then, it was a case of, right, let's make sure that they at least have an opportunity to hear that truth in school. And that's why Made for More focuses on learning for life and work, delivering workshops that address those big areas. And at the core is you matter and your decisions matter.
And what would you say, obviously then, as you said, identity is a big thing. What is it about our current culture that they're missing that?
Yeah, for me, it's not just young people, it's all of us. It's comparison, isn't it? Like, we live in a world and a society that is just built on comparison. And we constantly compare ourselves to other people. Like, that's what social media has become. You know, the sort of desire for likes, the desire for people to share our posts or to engage with us. And then we look at other people's pictures and we crave what they have. We want to look like them. We want the lifestyle they have. We watch so-called reality TV shows, you know, because we crave the lifestyle that they have, the maybe the body that they have, you know, the money that they have. And this just creates, I think, in all of us, this desire to be almost someone else. We don't feel good enough. You know, it's no surprising that as mental health issues increase, it coincides with the smartphone, you know, and the fact that we spend more and more time on social media, you know, watching YouTube, watching TV, in this sort of world of comparison. And as a result, you just never feel adequate, you know, and even in jobs, like adults, you know, we constantly feel we need to do better. Even in our ministries, in our churches, do we have enough people sitting in our seats? Do we have enough followers? You know, my friend has just got a promotion, why don't I have a promotion? And it just escalates where we all feel we need to compare, and we actually lose sight of the fact that, wait a second, God made me very specifically. I have gifts, I have talents and abilities, you know, that God has given me, and he has a purpose for my life that actually looks very different to the people around me.
Yeah.
But that gets lost, doesn't it, when you're just constantly wanting to be just like everyone else.
Sharon, just listening to Jamie there, if you think back to your teenage years, I know you were saying that really it was when you were at medical school, but when you think back to your teenage years, does any of what he's saying kind of resonate with maybe how you were feeling as a teenager?
Absolutely. Identity is a key word for me as well. Later on, it became losing the medical student, the doctor identity. But when I was a teenager, I was a really sporty teenager. I played hockey and tennis and ran cross country and everything. And that was very much my identity in school. But when I was nearly 17, I had an ankle injury and I suddenly couldn't do any of this. And I felt really, really bereft. I didn't know who I was. And at that time, looking back, I definitely lost weight after I stopped playing sport because I was scared that I was going to get really heavy because I wasn't running around all the time. And I also really felt I was having dark thoughts that I never admitted to anybody, and I felt an ominous presence around me at times. And looking back, it was all the harbingers of later mental illness. But this was 1998, and schools didn't have the same recognition of mental health and that awareness at that time. So I never got a diagnosis back then, and I had no input from psychiatric services. And I came through it and got better, and the first few years at medical school were great. But looking back, definitely that was a struggle that I can identify with.
Yeah. And Jamie, you were saying there about identity. In order to do that, you say in the article that you start teaching kids about God's identity. I'm just interested to know, how does that go down with kids, especially on church kids? How do they find that?
Yes, but I suppose so. What we do, there's almost two areas. So the school stuff is non-faith based in a sense. It's the Northern Ireland curriculum. You know, we go in and we just deliver fun workshops, but with a core content of you matter, your choices matter, you know. So for us, there's real value in that. So we won't mention God in those workshops because the reality, sadly, schools don't want us to.
Okay.
You know, we will have schools phone us up and say, we're thinking of getting your workshops in. We see you're Christian, but are your workshops faith-based or non-faith-based? And we'll say to them, listen, if you want them to be faith-based, they can be. But they'll say, no, you know, non-faith-based. So we're okay with that because we're still getting to add value to young people's lives. We're still getting to love them, you know, and And then hopefully they'll follow us on Instagram, they'll check out who we are, and that's where they'll see the gospel, because that's what we use our social media for. So when we go into churches then, or youth groups, it's very different, because again, you're being brought in because you are a Christian organisation, either to speak to Christian kids or to non-Christian kids that are coming along to youth groups. So we might get asked, can you focus it on mental health? Could it be a bit around self-esteem? So we'll go in, and again, we try to be really creative with it. You know, we're not going to sit and preach for an hour at young people. It's not how they work. You know, they want to be in group work. They want to be doing games. They want the music pumping. You know, they want it to get their attention. And within that, then, you can hit them with a really clear, you know, message around identity. So that's kind of what it looks like. And we'll pose questions to them a lot of the time about culture, because that's our sort of other buzzword, is it's identity and culture. Culture shapes us. You know, young people, even if they go to church and have a Christian family, 90% of their life is still non-Christian. You know, the culture around them, their school, their social media, the TV that they watch. So we take them on a bit of a journey, to be honest, through our workshops and churches, in terms of what's culture shape, what is shaping you? What does that look like? What does it actually say about God? And then we pose the question, well, who do we believe God is? And we'll go into that. And for us, we're trying to get young people to realise just who God is and how much he loves them. Because then out of that, you can really help them to see, you know, there's a God that loves me. He made me. He wants a relationship with me. That's where my identity needs to be. And from that, then, hopefully, they can start to love themselves and grow into his purpose for their lives. And, you know, when you're with them for an hour a night, you're just planting a seed, you know. And then that's why we love to share Instagram, because then they're locked in with us for the rest of the year, for the next few years, where they can watch our stories, they can watch our testimony videos, our Bible teaching. And we just kind of view it as a way to drip feed Jesus in, you know, and constantly plant more seeds. But yeah, that's where we're at. We're at the sort of the grassroots, plant the seed, throw it out there, and hopefully then their churches and their youth leaders can sort of water that and allow it to grow.
Yeah, build on it. Well, it sounds like you're doing a great and really valuable work, and we certainly wish you all the best with it. If any of our listeners are interested in having Made for More come to their school or youth group, you can find out how to go about this on their website, madeformoreni.co.uk. And it's also worth mentioning that Sharon Hastings' book, Wrestling With My Thoughts, is out now in all good bookshops or online. My thanks to Sharon and Jamie for joining me today and talking about their articles in the February edition of The Herald, which will be out in pews for Sunday the 26th of January, or available online at presbyterianireland.org/herald. You can also find details there of how to subscribe if you don't already, or you can just purchase a one-off copy from that website. If you want to hear more, why not subscribe to Herald Extra in your favourite podcast software to make sure you don't miss the next episode. We'd love to hear your feedback about the podcast, so please let us know either by tweeting with hashtag Herald Extra or by dropping me an email to herald@presbyterianireland.org. I'll be back soon with some more guests to look at the March 2020 edition. Thanks for listening today, and goodbye.